Hello. On this week's program, we listen back to a recent conversation with the veteran choreographer Paul Taylor. Jason Pfeiffer explores the creativity stirred up during presidential elections with a visit to the exhibit Patchwork Politics from George to George W. at the Heritage Centre Museum in Lancaster. Tom Keels takes us to historic Christchurch in Philadelphia to learn how it is remembering its lesser-known African-American congregants and their fight for freedom. And Susan Lewis looks at jewellery crafted by sculptor and mobile artist Alexander Calder, now an exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Despite being, by his own admission, a late bloomer, the now legendary American choreographer Paul Taylor has been performing or creating dance for more than half a century. He was in his third year of a swimming scholarship, studying painting at Syracuse University, when he experienced a dance recital. There and then, quote, it just hit him. He left Syracuse for New York City to begin studying at Juilliard, and within 4 years he was dancing for such luminaries as Martha Graham and George Balanchine, and had founded his own Paul Taylor Dance Company. In the 50-plus years since then, Taylor has attracted deep admiration and great controversy. His choreographic innovations, such as using common gestures, have evolved from a personal vernacular into the everyday language of dance. Some of the subjects of his work, marital rape, American imperialism, and incest, have sometimes overshadowed the larger body of his work, which has been, by and large, masterful. In May, I travelled to New York City to meet with Paul Taylor. Well, let's start in your childhood. Was there music in your house when you were growing up?
No, I didn't hear any classical music until I came to New York, except for Walt Disney's Fantasia. So I'm, you know, really musically got a late start.
So what was the original dance impulse? Was it a kinetic feeling? Was it responding to music?
I like to move. I just wanted to be a dancer, you know. I thought somebody else would make up the steps for me, and I wanted to perform.
It came to you later than some people in this day and age when we have kids having dance lessons at 4 and 5. You were in your teens.
I was in my third year of college. Yeah, I got a late start. I had a lot of, you know, catching up to do. So I left college immediately and came to New York and enrolled in Juilliard and took, you know, a lot of classes every day.
How then did the creative impulse evolve from the performing impulse? Oh, were you feeling dances in your body as you were performing other people's work?
Not my own dances. No. You know, at that time, nobody got paid for dancing. And even with Balanchine's company, I think it was, like, I was a guest artist, like $10 a performance or something. And Martha only had one New York season a year. So there was a lot of time in between to ask some friends to work with and make up some pieces and perform them. That's how it started.
And how good were those early pieces now that you look back at them?
Not very. Well, a couple of them weren't bad. Some of them we're still doing. There's one called Three Epitaphs that just won't go away. And Oriole was an early piece. So there were a couple not bad. But some of them I don't think we should show again.
When, in those days, you were creating new work, what was driving it? Was it music? Was it wishing to tell a story? Or was it just the kinetic impulse?
Oh, well, the music, of course. And if I had any idea about a story element, there was that. And visually, you know, to make a picture, a frame picture. Proscenium's like a frame, like a painting. And use of spatial patterns. And sometimes a little mathematics comes into it, or architecture. Yeah.
And the fact that you were along the way inventing your own language that has now become a part of the vernacular, the smaller, more discreet gestures, the non-traditional dance steps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There was that element of natural movement that I got interested in.
What's needed of, or is there a priority for a Paul Taylor dancer? Is it all about technique? Is it all about the body, the strength, the ability to carry this work?
I think it's basically about passion, or should be. And you know, dancers these days are technically a lot better than my generation. And of course it's needed. It's a given. But the passion for dance and the ability of a dancer to communicate different things as whatever the dance requires is of major importance.
And therefore, any body type, not any degree of technical ability, I would imagine.
No, I know if somebody's fat, 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 that's out. I mean, maybe somebody would want to make a whole company of really, you know, overweight people. But I don't. I haven't done. That's one thing I haven't done yet. So their looks are important, of course. They have to, you know, look like gods and goddesses, in my mind.
Over the years, you have stirred proper society into outrage often by the subject matter of your dances and even your use of music. When everything was avant-garde, you decided you were going to go back to Baroque music. You were going to just keep moving the goalposts. Was that purposeful, or was that just what you felt at the time?
I try not to follow trends, you know, and I like to challenge myself and try for something that I haven't tried. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But I never set out to enrage people, you know. On the other hand, if someone really objects strongly to something, it means I've gotten through in some way.
You know? Veteran choreographer Paul Taylor speaking with me in May at his studios in New York City.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
November 4th, Election Day, is a little over 90 days away, and the presidential campaigns are in full swing. There's evidence of the race for the White House at every corner. Windows and roadside signs, T-shirts, posters, buttons, and bumper stickers. Political paraphernalia has long been a part of campaign season, and memorabilia inspired by the candidates has long been sought after by collectors. One special collection of politically themed items is now on display at the Heritage Center Museum in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the exhibition commemorates the art of politics, largely through the medium of textiles.
The show is called Patchwork Politics, from George to George W., and features a hodgepodge of collectibles from centuries of U.S. presidential politics. Silk banners, flags, handkerchiefs, pins, ribbons, dolls, and quilts. With about 120 pieces in all, the compilation is owned by a Pennsylvania-based couple who, for the sake of the valuable collection's security, wish to remain anonymous. The donor says that she and her retired husband didn't have a lot of specific criteria as they assembled their extensive collection over the years.
We go for it all. When we see something, actually, I don't know that we've seen all that much that it was not appealing, unless it was, you know, dirty language or things like that. We'd look at it and laugh, but not want it to have on our shelf.
You describe yourself as a political collector.
Or junkie.
Or junkie. How did you get into this?
Well, we had a friend who owned a button collection, and we really got excited about his political collection, and we began to buy a few ourselves as we saw them.
After their friend went through a divorce, he decided to sell his collection, and so the couple bought it, quickly expanding their small assortment and cementing a deep commitment to the hobby of collecting political artifacts. though they don't place many restrictions on themselves when hunting for collectibles from antique stores, auctions, trade shows, and even the internet. One area of concentration for the donors has been politically themed quilts.
I've always quilted. My grandmother quilted, and I've always been interested in sewing.
Quilts form the core of the Heritage Center Museum exhibit, Patchwork Politics. The museum's president, Peter Siebert, who helped design the exhibition, says though many people collect political memorabilia, the holdings in this show are exemplary.
What makes this collection kind of special is there aren't actually very many buttons and badges. This is the big stuff.
It was clear to Siebert early on that the visiting collection was not going to fit in the Heritage Museum's normal exhibition space. So they did something they hadn't done before. They pulled out the museum's permanent collection and put it in storage. One of the first items in view when walking into the exhibition hall is the oldest piece of the collection, a quilt with images of George Washington.
This one was probably made sometime between 1799 when Washington died and maybe about 1835. And there are just a couple of these known. And of course, what you see about it is the size. Look how big this thing is. And, you know, it's a copper plate printed fabric, meaning it was printed up probably in England for the American market. You know, and it's got George Washington here being driven by two leopards to heaven.
Beyond the George Washington quilt, Patchwork Politics features nearly 30 other quilts, expressions of both creativity and political zeal. There's a streak of lightning pattern quilt made up of stitched together silk ribbons from 17th century campaigns. Flags and fabric prints of candidates' faces are incorporated into intricate designs. One quilt depicts past presidents crying over the sins of Richard Nixon, while another humorously summarizes the 1992 campaign of Bill Clinton. In addition to the quilts, the exhibition is peppered with other memorabilia, items commemorating the women's suffrage movement, a life-size donkey painted on a sign for a John F. Kennedy campaign stop, an FDR nodding head doll, sheet music for songs about Teddy Roosevelt, and a wind-up Jimmy Carter peanut toy. Peter Siebert says this exhibition demonstrates how political tactics haven't changed all that much. For instance, one section highlights the campaign of William Henry Harrison, heralded by his party as a man of the people, who lived in a log cabin and drank hard cider.
Except he grew up on a plantation that had lots of slaves, and he probably didn't go out and plow the fields a whole lot and certainly wasn't hanging out in a log cabin. But it was an image created by the party and the machine to promote his candidacy. Pretty good parallels between then and now.
Siebert says it's clear that people's passion for political campaigns hasn't diminished either. Teddy Roosevelt window curtains and the fact that women, who couldn't even vote, would spend months making quilts with political themes demonstrate a presidential fervor through the decades. Yet while a lot has remained the same, the collection donor says a lot has changed.
Certainly a lot more money, a lot more technology and, you know, television, radio. I can remember my parents listening on the radio and then so excited when we got our first television to see some candidates.
Patchwork Politics shows that one of the many things the advent of TV sparked around the time of Dwight Eisenhower's campaigns was the creation of bold political apparel, clothing meant to be spectacular in the new era of television. There's a dress and matching gloves covered with the name Ike, a 1964 Barry Goldwater dress and sash, and a Bill Clinton jean jacket. Siebert says while the 17th and 18th century components of the collection offer an interesting history lesson, it's the items from more recent memory that elicit spirited responses from visitors.
People will latch on one or the other. You know, the Bill Clinton stuff they're going to, you know, make fun of, or they'll make fun of the George Bush and Richard Nixon stuff. And it kind of goes back and forth with that. And that's why the 20th century stuff to me is so much fun to see people's responses to that, because that you can figure out where people's positions are pretty fast.
This current election cycle is momentous in various ways, most notably for having an African-American in serious contention for the White House for the first time. But considering the commentary provided by political memorabilia over the past two centuries, from apparel to toys to quilts, it's evident that presidential politics and the passion they generate haven't changed all that much.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Patchwork Politics from George to George W. is at the Heritage Center Museum in downtown Lancaster through December 31st. For over 16,000 Sundays, that's every Sunday for the past 313 years, religious services have been celebrated at historic Christ Church at 2nd and Market Streets in Philadelphia. Christchurch has been called the nation's church for the role its parishioners played in winning America's independence during the Revolution. Now WRTI's Tom Keels takes us to Christchurch to learn how it is remembering its lesser-known congregants and their fight for freedom.
Among the many volumes in the archives of Christchurch is a baptismal register for the years 1750 to 1762. The faded ink in the leather-bound ledger records the baptism of Hannah, infant daughter of wealthy merchant William Bingham, and his wife Mary. Directly below this baptismal entry is one for another baby girl, Elizabeth, daughter of Joss and Pleasant, slaves of the widow Hazel. This document is one of the few surviving clues to the two separate congregations at 18th-century Christ Church, the white elite and the black slaves and freedmen who served them.
This church would have served as our national cathedral.
Tour guide Jabbar Wright leads some of the 250,000 tourists who visit Christ Church every year.
So when the signers of the Declaration of Independence weren't over at Independence Hall, all 56 of those men would have been here in this church. 15 of those signers were active members, and 7 of them are buried here at our church and at our burial grounds.
Founded in 1695, Christ Church was the first Anglican house of worship in predominantly Quaker Philadelphia. When the Anglicans grew more powerful in the early 18th century, they replaced their humble church with the elaborate Georgian building it occupies today. Executive Director of Christ Church Preservation Trust, Donald Smith, understands the unique role that the structure played in early Philadelphia.
The steeple was the highest structure in North America and would go on to be the highest structure for the next 56 years, and a real beacon, especially for the ships coming up the Delaware to this, the largest city in North America.
The worshipers at Christ Church included the wealthiest men in colonial Philadelphia, such as William Bingham and Robert Morris. These were the merchants and bankers who made Philadelphia the most glittering metropolis in the British Empire outside of London, with their townhouses, their silver, their elegant furniture, and their slaves. Among this class, Smith explains, owning slaves was the rule rather than the exception.
Many, many of the wealthier people, and even the middle-income white people, owned slaves. Benjamin Franklin owned slaves. Benjamin Rush, the head of the Abolition Society, owned slaves while he was the head of the Abolition Society. Even William Penn owned slaves.
Some of the slaves were famous in their own right. One woman named Alice, who reportedly lived to the age of 116, was renowned for her stories of lighting the pipe of William Penn a century earlier. Actor Diane Johnson, who plays the role of a colonial slave at Christ Church, recounts one of Alice's favorite stories.
She spoke, too, of Christ Church. She told him that when she went to that church, it was so small, she could place the palms of her hands on the ceiling of the center aisle and walk the very length of it without removing them. I smiled when I thought about what she'd think of that big church up there just above the high street.
Slave ownership persisted at Christ Church until well after the Revolution. The 9 slaves that President George Washington brought to Philadelphia in 1790 have been well documented by the recent excavations at the nearby President's House. Some local slave owners, like Benjamin Rush and Benjamin Franklin, freed their slaves after the Revolution. But according to Donald Smith, one Christ Church parishioner, Benjamin Winekoop, held on to his slave as long as he could.
Absalom Jones purchased the freedom of his wife and children from the Winekoops, and several times he tried to purchase his own freedom, and Winekoop did not want to sell it to him because he was an important, valuable commodity.
After finally buying his own freedom in 1784, Jones founded the first African-American Episcopal parish in this country and became the first black priest in the new Episcopal Church. 2 centuries after Jones's ordination, the leadership of the Episcopal Church in the United States asked its member churches to confront the roles that they had played in American slavery. For Donald Smith and other members of Christ Church, This became an opportunity to examine a long-neglected part of their past.
So we have begun to learn stories that are focused around Christchurch about the slave owners, about the enslaved people, about the people who bought and sold slaves. All these stories that focused around the people from Christchurch. And we are telling those stories.
Drawing on historical records, Christchurch parishioner Trish Troilo created a two-person presentation entitled Slavery in Philadelphia. Jabbar Wright serves as narrator, and Diane Johnson creates the character of Sarah, describing her life as a slave in colonial Philadelphia. As with other 18th-century slaves, every aspect of Sarah's life, from birth to death, is controlled by her white owners.
I met my husband on a Sunday. Yeah. I'd come to Christchurch with the Edwards family, and my husband, he came with their neighbors, the Roses. I always sit in the back of the church, and my husband, we saw each other across the pews. Well, our masters being friends and neighbors, though, they let us see one another during the week, and they let us get married. We had children, a boy and a girl. And my master let us keep them.
For Diane Johnson, the 18th century African slave Sarah, although fictional, has an important legacy to pass down to her as a 21st century African American woman.
So many things about her speaks to me. Like she wanted to survive. She talked about survival in her family. She talks about being invisible. She talks about wanting her children and her grandchildren to have better lives and to know certain things and passing these things on. Well, that's what I want. That's what I desire for my family as well.
As the current presidential campaign has reminded us, the aftermath of slavery is still an open wound in American society. The members of Christ Church hope that their Slavery in America program will be a healing experience for its black and white visitors, enabling them to discuss and understand this painful subject on a personal level.
WRTI's Tom Keels. He's the author of Forgotten Philadelphia, Lost Architecture of the Quaker City, and Philadelphia's Rittenhouse Square. Slavery in America runs Tuesday and Thursday afternoons through the end of September at Christ Church and at Christ Church Burial Ground at 5th and Arch Streets in Philadelphia. One family name spans three generations of Philadelphia's artistic heritage, and the three Calders, all named Alexander, have left their own individual marks on the city. Alexander Milne Calder, who crafted over 200 figures for City Hall, including his iconic bronze sculpture of William Penn on top, his son Alexander Sterling Calder, whose sculptures adorn Swan Memorial Fountain on Logan Circle and other parts of the city, and his son Alexander Calder, inventor of the mobile, whose work Ghost hangs in the Great Stair Hall of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to an exhibition that shows another side to the grandson in this remarkable lineage.
The first work of art in the show of Calder jewelry at the Philadelphia Museum of Art is a necklace of curling ribbons of hammered brass. Seemingly suspended in space, it drapes across an invisible wearer, over unseen shoulders, down an imagined back. Alone in the rotunda, like a hostess at the door, it invites us into the light-filled gallery beyond. This is jewelry, but not in the ordinary sense.
It's really about body ornamentation. This is not jewelry in the refined sort of dainty sense.
Elizabeth Agro is the museum's associate curator for modern and contemporary craft and decorative arts.
This is about sculpture. Sculpture for the body.
Coming from a family of artists, Alexander Calder first tried another direction. Drawn to mechanics and engineering, he graduated from Stevens Institute of Technology in 1919. But he turned to painting and sculpting, first in New York, then in Paris in the 1920s, where he mingled with surrealist, experimental, and modernist artists of the time. The creative impulse, says curator of American art Kathleen Foster, was in his bones.
He just grew up with all of this legacy of sculpture. He couldn't help it. He was making stuff out of everyday objects and scraps and jewelry for his wife and so forth. It's a kind of natural art making that I think really characterizes his outlook.
While his father and grandfather sculpted classical figures, carving in stone and casting in bronze, Calder experimented with color, shape, subject, and movement, using wire, glass, and other found materials. He gained fame from his Calder Circus, a miniature reproduction of a circus made from these ordinary materials, which he displayed and performed by making his circus figures move. Then Calder lifted sculpture into the air and made it move. The creations for which he would become best known were his abstract sculptures that suspended, moved in the air, described as mobiles by the French artist Marcel Duchamp. Calder would sometimes mount a sculpture or mobile atop a stabile, which was another sculpture made out of sheet metal fixed to the ground. Jewelry, though, may have been where it all began.
He began making jewelry when he was a child for his sister's dolls, so clearly he was amused by the idea of body adornment.
Alexander Rower, Calder's grandson and director of the Calder Foundation, says Calder made jewelry in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s as both a means of expression and a way to make money. Each of the over 1,800 works he created during his lifetime was one of a kind. They expressed, says Rower, a sensibility that was anti-pretentious.
He presented his jewelry and he invited you to participate in his kind of utopian ideals of attitudes about value and attitudes about beauty and attitudes about adornment, and all those things were very unusual. I mean, these aren't diamond necklaces, you know?
And this exhibition of about 100 necklaces, bracelets, brooches, earrings, crowns, and tiaras feels more like a show of small sculptures than a trip through Tiffany's. Pieces are made from wire, hammered metal, and shards of glass and ceramics, attached by an African technique of stapling instead of soldering. Calder was, in some ways, a product of his time, say Elizabeth Agro and Kathleen Foster.
The artists of the early 20th century were very excited by revitalizing Western art with the abstraction that they saw in world cultures, and I see this in Calder's work.
He's looking at floral forms, he's looking at ancient motifs like the spiral, inferencing pre-Columbian art and jewelry, and also African art and jewelry as well.
The first part of the show highlights jewelry he made for his wife, Louisa James, whom he first spotted in 1929 on the deck of an ocean liner.
He saw her with all her hair all completely ringleted up. It was a lot of ringlets on an ocean liner. It's very moist, and she looked like Medusa. So he made this bracelet that spells out Medusa, and it sort of forecasts the amazing jewelry he would be making for the future for her, but also for other people and through his exhibitions and such.
Another section explores how he showed and sold his jewelry, and there are photographs of celebrities like Georgia O'Keeffe and Peggy Guggenheim wearing his work. The necklaces in particular are large and ornamental. Some have moving parts like tiny mobiles. All have personality, but perhaps none more so than the jealous husband necklace displayed and shown in a photograph on Angelica Houston.
It's just what it sounds like. It's this incredible necklace, very tour de force, with a lot of cantilevered swirls with daggers hanging out of it. So if you were to hug this woman, you would be poked in the eye.
This show reveals a personal side of an artist, much of whose work is more public. Alexander Calder is like and unlike his famous father and grandfather, says Kathleen Foster.
All of them, in a way, are very interested in public art, and I think Calder grew into that, coming out of his background as an engineer and a kind of playful sense of art as part of daily life. And I think Calder carries that tradition through in a very abstract and modern vocabulary.
The challenge of a show like this is that a piece of Calder jewelry is an artistic expression made complete by the wearer, who then becomes part of the art. But this jewelry is so evocative as art, it also stands on its own, piquing curiosity, engaging the imagination, and providing insight into an artist integral to the continuing story of Philadelphia art.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Calder Jewelry is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art's Perelman Building until November 2nd. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.